We're at the seventh lecture on nature. And we need to consider this. For untold millennia, the parenthetical context of man was a nature so limited that we can hardly imagine what a small sliver of experience was available for human beings to maturity. In fact, the natural experience of primitive man was so narrow that very quickly he was forced to develop a supernatural context in order to help him to mature. Nature, in a primordial way for primitive man, was the experience of night and day, of rain or sunshine, of clouds, of seasonal changes, and not much else. All human beings were fairly limited in their access to natural experience. So that what we mean by nature, when we say that all of our self-unfoldment begins with nature, and that nature is not a thing, but is in fact an experiential flow. In fact, we can characterize it now as a transformational medium. That nature, as it exists, is a transformational medium. It is that flow within which changes occur and happen, and its nature is such that the changes have a cycle, so that we could say that ecology characterizes nature, meaning that there is change in a graduated, staged, stepped way, which it always is characteristic of nature. So that the primordial way of experiencing nature and coming to a symbolic image of what is occurring, a circle with a seasonal cycle, was the normal way in which man characterized his experiential basis for self-unfoldment. And you can see from this that it was quite natural for any experiencing being to consider himself a part of this flow. It's difficult for us to understand that there was no center. There was no sense of center. The whole psychological movement of the 60s, centering, did not exist for primitive man. The discovery of the center, the discovery of the awareness of the center, was a catastrophic development. And the first manifestations of the discovery of the center occur in human societies when ceramics appear. Because in order to fashion a ceramic, you have to be able to find the center. And there's quite a difference from a ceramic which is formed with a kind of a coiled clay quality and one which is thrown on a wheel. And as soon as you have ceramics that are thrown on a wheel, you have a new sense of self that comes into human society, no matter where in the world that it happens. What comes into play then is a kind of an awareness, not a consciousness, but an awareness that the center is as important as the cycle, so that the rim of the wheel, which is the cycle, has a hub then. And of course, it doesn't take a human being very long to realize, wait a minute, since there's a rim and a hub, there must be connecting spokes. And then the wheel comes out as a natural image, as a kind of a mandala flash insight in consciousness. So that before there is any kind of a wheel, in fact, there is the image of the wheel in someone's psyche. So that the phrase then, the wheel of the seasons, becomes a really viable term. And you find this, it happens very recently in terms of human history. Now you can go back archaeologically and you can find in various parts of the world the actual centuries, however many millennia ago, that throne pottery begins to occur and exist. And if we go back, say, more than 10,000 years, we don't find any of it anywhere in the world. So that the sense of center is connected with the development of throne ceramics. Notice also that ceramics, which are made in a thrown way or in a coiled way, also have to be baked. The development of the idea of cooking material in order to make it usable for man goes along with the idea of cooking your food. And is complemented in a way by the idea of raising your food, of farming, of herding, and so forth. Now all of these stages are definite. They don't just occur in little dribbles, but when they occur, it's like human beings cross a threshold and all of a sudden, everywhere in that region, the word has spread and the activity evens itself out. But in very primitive times, like just as recent as before the last ice age, about 12,000 years ago, none of these occurrences happened. So that we have to understand that for ourselves, for the kinds of beings that we are, the experience dimension that we take for granted is, to use a Midwest phrase, brand new. And so it takes an act of creative imagination on our part to try to sympathetically get back into the state where we're seeing nature qua nature, nature before it's expanded by man's capacities. The first threshold that moves from nature qua nature, nature as it is, to nature which is influenced by man's selectivity, the very first step in that transition is the development of totem images. Totem images. That is to say, there is a giant step between seeing a bear out there and having the image of a bear in here, and feeling related to the image of the bear in your mind. When you are related in your own judgment to the image of the bear in your mind, you are also then related to the bear out there. And there is a bear clan then, because there are other people who are related to the same image in their minds. And whenever there is, in fact, a natural bear, you are in the presence of your totem image. This is a real giant step. It's the first step in interiorization. It's the first time that nature gets interiorized and assimilated to the human, we would say personality, but it's stretching the word personality. Psyche is a better term here. So that the first really powerful image in the psyche, that the interiorization mode is moving towards the deep self, comes from having a totem image. Now that's why I passed out about a month ago a Xerox copy of Franz Boas's article on the origin of totemism. And if some of you don't have that, we can arrange to have copies run off for you. And I assured you that if you followed the trail of Boas's article, in other words, his article on the origin of totemism appeared in his collected essay book. And that, in fact, that essay was a culmination of a whole development on totemism that he had published in the 31st annual report of the Bureau of American Ethnology. That this 1,000-page volume, published by the U.S. government in 1910, on Tsimshian mythology. Why on Tsimshian mythology? He was doing anthropological work with on the northwest coast in northern BC, British Columbia. So that his understanding in the article, The Origin of Totemism, is informed by this tremendous study. This book on Tsimshian myths that came out in 1902 is the original work published by Boas before his work on Tsimshian mythology. So that the article on the origin of totemism is like the cream of the cream. It's a summation of a whole lifetime of work of trying to understand what totemism is in terms of a specific people. And Boas himself had understood those people as well as anyone who was not in that tribe ever will do. And his transcription of the Tsimshian texts in here, in the 1902 publication, also published by the Smithsonian, was based on research work that he did in the 19th century in person there in northern BC on the coast. So that I chose that Boas article for you because it had the characteristic of being not only trustworthy by someone who really knew what they were doing, but because I could show you how that particular article occurred, its genesis in intellectual stages. So that the first stage is the experience of the Tsimshian Indians themselves. The second, the recounting of their mythology orally in person to him. The third, the publishing of the texts in a phonetic transliteration of the Tsimshian language with the English equivalents underneath it. Fourth, the volume synthesizing the meaning in Tsimshian mythology in this report. And fifth, the article, the little 7 or 8 page article, which summarizes in a symbolic way this entire range of experience, like a pyramid. Now, if you take the pyramid of Boas's expressive experience, his written and his own personal experience, and you go to the top of that pyramid and you drop a plumb line so that it goes straight through the center of that pyramid down to the very center of the base, that line would represent symbolically the synthesizing idea. And the synthesizing idea in that structure is the notion of a totem. So that when one comes to really consciously understanding the essential center line of that whole building, that whole structure of understanding, we need to appropriate for ourselves not only some experience with the various levels, sympathetically, but to identify the synthesizing idea and to grasp its notion and then put it into that pyramid of experience. In other words, I'm teaching you now how to see a shape of wholeness with your experience, sympathizing with someone else's experience, and your intelligence comprehending the synthesizing idea and putting the two together, so that you then have a pretty good grasp experientially and consciously of what's going on here. It's a case in point. You can do this with any subject area. I'm delineating this for you almost like a little beginning geometrical axiomatic lesson, so that you grasp the procedure, the method. And I'm using totemism because it is fundamental to our development. It's essential for our experience of nature, but also it has all of these spin-offs. It acquaints you with anthropology, it acquaints you with an intellectual procedure, it also begins to stimulate your sense of empathy. But, like anything else, you have to be able to do this yourself. So, what we need to do is we need to take a couple of other examples of primordial man, say three or four other examples of primordial man, and for your various groups to try to find the synthesizing idea in the pyramid of experience of several other groups. So each of the discussion groups should take another example and just in your discussion try to determine what the synthesizing idea might be. And of course, the first thing you run up against is that you don't have any information. You don't have any experience. And I want you to run up against that, because that throws you back to the beginning and throws you back to the example of the Tsimshian Indians, so that you'll appropriate what I'm giving to you in a way commensurate with your own need. In other words, we're creating a false need now that the groups find a synthesizing idea, but it becomes a real need effectively in your educational experience. The other groups that I'd like you to think of, one of the groups is the Ainu in northern Japan. Second group, the Australian Aborigines, and I think probably the Arnhem Land region of the Australia Aborigines. The third, archaic Chinese. Now let's take those three, and the various groups will have to determine which one of those that you're going to look at. And what you need to do in the groups, each group take one of these three. Each discussion group take one of these three. And I don't care which ones, so that you'll have to decide in an intergroup fashion. Notice this is the first time that the groups will have to contact the other groups. I hope that you understand that I'm working here with a very large strategy, and that you're just now beginning to see that there are a lot of dimensions to this. This education is complete. All the dimensions that need to be taken care of are there. That's why it takes so long for it to unfold, because there's a lot to do. Each of the groups, try to find on your own a synthesizing idea. The ancient Chinese, the Arnhem Land Australian Aborigines, the Ainu of northern Japan. They're now of northern Japan. At one time they were through most of Honshu Island too, not just Hokkaido. Now, in order to help you The example of totemism in Tsimshian mythology, I've set out here four books which help to understand the idea, the notion of a totem. These are classic works. Three of them are classic works, and one of them is fairly recent and good as a pictorial resource. The three classic works, the first one is by Sir James George Frazer, and it's the supplement to his big four-volume series, Totemism and Exogamy, and this is called Totemica. Sir James George Frazer is the author of The Golden Bough in 13 volumes, and many, many other works. This was done in 1937, right at the end of Frazer's illustrious life. And so his book on Totemica is a seminal work in trying to understand the notion of a totem. The second is a little tiny book written by the great French anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss, and just called Totemism. And the third book is in two volumes, published in Canada. The National Museum of Canada is a wonderful, wonderful outfit, and they have published excellent works. This two-volume set on totem poles by Marius Barbeau, who is extremely well-versed. He wrote about a dozen books, which are all just quite excellent. These are very hard to find. This two-volume Totem Poles was published in 1950. So this has a lot of information in it. And then this little illustrated guide, a simple introduction to Totem Poles, which was published just a few years ago. This was the University of British Columbia Press. 1981. So UBC Press, and then National Museum of Canada, then a reprint of Levi Strauss's Totemism, and then the original edition of Fraser's Totemica. These four volumes will help you in connection with the Boas material, so that if you glance at these, using the article by Boas as a spearhead, you should be able, within an hour or a couple of hours, at least to begin to get some insights into this synthesizing idea of the notion of a totem and how it structures this whole development of human experience. Now, this is not an abstract lesson of some little slice of life. It is a whole horizon of development that every human group on the planet has gone through. Every human group. So that in our psyches, at the most fundamental level of our psyches, you talk about the structure of the unconscious. Well, the whole foundation floor is this. In other words, if you go through, let's take Jung for a second. If you go through a Jungian therapy, an analytical psychological therapy, and you penetrate down through the various levels, the last level that you come to, which has an image, is a geometrical level. And that's the level that holds the totem images. Beyond that, there are no images. Beyond that, that level of the psyche has no images whatsoever. It has no discernible structure whatsoever because it is a oneness. Or, as we would say in Taoism, it's a zero base. There's just a silent light. But the first manifestation is a geometricity, geometric structure. Now, it's interesting for our purposes because we're using various world cultures The first time that ceramics appear in classical ancient Greece, archaic Greece, they are decorated with geometric structures. So that the earliest Greek ceramics, the earliest, are called, in terms of archaeology, proto-geometric. Can you see that what I'm giving you now is a whole cycle of information that holds together all the way through? Now, why do we need this? We need this because our nature to us is not this little sliver, but nature to us is such a panorama by now. It's such a kaleidoscopic sphere that, frankly, human beings of even 100 years ago, just that far, our great-grandmothers, our great-grandfathers would have suffered vertigo, would have been disoriented, would not have been able to function. So much so that most human beings alive now filter out the possibilities of natural experience because they can't handle the full sphere. Which means that if you filter out, you're regressing, and it also means then that the motifs that you're going to use for self-development belong to another century. They belong to the 19th century at best. And it's very tragic to become 19th century woman in the 21st century. That's a real tragedy. Or to become 19th century man at the dawn of the 21st century and have 19th century values at the very best. But this regression, of course, the trouble with regressions is that they slide backwards very easily, and usually you don't make it to the top of the regression. You usually slide somewhere back, so that a lot of people come out somewhere around the 17th century. And to try and be a 17th century Puritan in the 21st century is going to be real bad news. It's a real brick wall. So we need to at least have the courage to make an attempt to see what kind of amphitheater nature and natural experience now have for us. The best way to stretch a plane into a sphere is to take polar opposite movements, one to the zenith and one to the nadir, and run a center pole up through the plane of experience. This center pole is called, mythically, a world axis. A world axis. Why? Because when you have that axis, it creates a world. Instead of having a plateau of learning, one has a whole world of possibility. That's the way that you would talk about it, using accurate language. So that you're being stretched from a plateau to a world. In other words, you're not looking anymore for a place to stand, but you're looking for a dimension to be mobile in. And there's all the difference in the world in a personality, which is from the get-go begun with an eye towards having mobility, from a personality which is trying to entrench itself and defend some little sandbox corner of a plateau. In other words, it's a very satisfying thing to an autistic personality to be able to defend a room against the world, a room of one's own, as Virginia Woolf once described. There's a great difference between that and someone who is mobile in a world of possibility. So we need to at least acquaint ourselves, whatever you decide to do is your own business, but you have to at least acquaint yourself with this radical difference. And the way that a world of possibility is constructed, or perhaps you don't like the term constructed, the way in which it's engineered, or perhaps you don't like that word. The Greeks used the term poiesis, which we would use a translation of created, but that's kind of theological. The Greek term actually poiesis means poetically created. So maybe we'll use that. Or just use the Greek term poiesis. The way in which a world axis is made poetically is to extend both at the same time the aspirant zenith and the deepening nadir. Now for us, nature is expanded by two complementary modes, and the 20th century has been dominated by the expansion of the plateau of experience to a world of possibility by the construction of a single world axis. And that world axis is astronomy and physics. And the ultimate is extragalactic astronomy and nuclear particle physics. So that we have two textbooks then which go together, which help us at this particular section to size up what we're dealing with. The first is Timothy Ferris's book, Galaxies, and the second is The Tao of Physics by Friedrich Capra. So that these books form these kinds of poles. Galaxies is the zenith, and the Tao of Physics is the nadir, and the line between the two of them is the world axis. And what is that line between them in terms of a synthesizing idea? What is the line between galaxies and particle physics? That line is cosmology. So that the synthesizing idea of the world axis of the dimensions of possibility in our lifetime is cosmology. It's not always this case for human beings. At different epochs and different conditions, there are different world axes. Ours happens to be cosmology. So that it comes in to nature exactly here in the center. Now let's retrench a little bit. Let's retract and let's come back and let's look at this structure. Some of you who are new don't have this pamphlet. We'll run off copies for you. If you look at the page on nature, this is like a part of our blueprint. We're trying to construct a house. We're trying to construct a home to live in. And at this particular stage of building the structure, the blueprint reads like this. This page, nature. And in fact, if you were building a building, this page would be where you dig out in the earth to lay the foundation. We haven't even laid the foundation yet. We're just digging out openings. We're digging out an opening to lay a foundation in. The actual foundation will be rituals. So if you look at this page on nature, you'll notice that it has a structure. And now you can tell that because it has a structure, there must be a synthesizing idea informing this whole program. And in fact, there is. And by the time we get to the end of this year, you should be able to intuit that synthesizing idea. The structure here is that there are three basic parts to the nature, each one taking a month, each one taking 4 weeks. And then there's a fourth part, which is one additional week, a 13th week. So that nature as a stage in our education takes 13 weeks. In fact, each of the sections takes 13 weights. Always in this 4-4-4-1 format. In other words, it's a quaternary with the weight distributed towards three levels of extension and withdrawn from one level of extension. In other words, it has the shape. If you were to look at a natural image of this, a very good natural image of this is a clover, a three-leaf clover with a stem. So that each of the sections has that kind of a quality. It has a clover-like quality. Or if you play cards, it's a club, isn't it? In the deck of clubs, yeah. The first 4 weeks were an introduction to nature and an introduction to the whole course. And we began with Thoreau because we wanted to have an example of a human being who comported to nature as deeply as possible. And Henry David Thoreau happens to be a very good example. There are others that we could have taken. The way that I learned 30 years ago was through John Muir. And we could have taken John Muir. But Thoreau will do. And along with Thoreau, we had this book on Origins by Richard Leakey. And most of you got paper copies of this book on Origins. And the complement to it was the I Ching, the Book of Changes. So that we had Origins and the I Ching, with Thoreau as a kind of a glue holding these together. And in fact, Thoreau is a very good glue holding Origins and the I Ching together. That was the first month, and that was like an introduction, and we didn't make much of the fact that this structure is archetypal. It's chosen and selected through a lot of experience, more than 20 years of experience, of trying to teach this and find out what works, very pragmatic. But this form allows for a transformation, the transformation to galaxies and Tao of physics, without losing a step, so that we can move from the I Ching to the Tao of physics, and we can move from origins to galaxies very easily. Notice the consistency in terms of cosmological development. You can go from origins to galaxies in the same breath, and you can go from the I Ching to the Tao of physics in the same breath. There's no difficulty whatsoever. Only now, in the middle of nature, and the first part is labeled movement, and the second month, the second part is labeled counter-movement. What we've done is an archetypal pattern of beginning to do something, and now, while we're still doing it, we're starting to reflect on, well, what are we doing? So the movement is just an activity, and the counter activity is not to stop the activity, but to think about the activity. Because the thought about an activity is always reflexive. So it's counter in the sense of reflexive rather than anti. Now, if you want to symbolize it in terms of gesture, there's this, I'm moving the hand clockwise, and there's this, I'm moving the hand counterclockwise. Notice that it's the same instrument, and it's the same kind of vectoring. It's just a reverse. This is also archetypal. The ideational expression of this, I'll just give you a clue. We won't even get to this for another year. The ideational expression of this is that the way of integration is perfectly balanced by the way of differentiation. If you want to understand how to differentiate, you must understand how you integrate it. If you have one or the other process in its true sequence, you can determine the other accurately every single time. In other words, if you get the sequence of integration, you will know ahead of time what the sequence of differentiation is, with mathematical exactness, or vice versa. If you know the sequence of differentiation, you can figure out the sequence of integration to whatever degree of specificity you need, the nth degree. Now, late 20th century human beings like ourselves have this facility. We have the facility now to understand the whole in terms of figuring out from the half that we have what the other half isn't. If we have the sequence of the visible, we can figure out what the sequence of the invisible is. So we have then in our nature program the first 4 weeks with origins in the I Ching, and now we're in the second 4 weeks with the Tao of Physics and galaxies. Now the third 4 weeks, we're only going to have one book, which is the Double Helix. Why are we going to have only one book? Because the stand is the kind of openness that's made by these two movements. The movement, which I'll start it clockwise, does not come to a full closure, but reverses its field and goes into a counter movement, leaving a little bit of a gap. And when the counter movement comes around, it doesn't close, but leaves a similar gap. So that when you have, in this fashion, a movement and a counter movement, there is a third feature, which is invisible. It's not anything in itself, but it's the gap that's made by virtue of the way in which you moved and then counter moved. That third element is the entrance through the membrane of human activity, the entrance of the divine. It's the soul corridor. It's the way that divine insight comes in. And it's like, let's use the Navajo idea of a spirit trail. Whenever Navajo weavers make a rug, you probably know this, they leave one thread out of the composition. One thread that runs off through the composition out to the edge. This is the spirit trail. It's a way of tipping your hat to the universe. Of saying, I know that I can get 99.9% perfection, but no human being gets 100% perfection. And here's my tip of the hat. Here's one thread that I leave out of place. It is called a spirit trail, not an error. See, part of the arrogance of machine man is that he goes for 100% perfection and attains it and asphyxiates his psyche. He doesn't understand. You don't. Perfection is not 100%. Perfection is like ivory soap. That's perfection. You leave some of that impurity there as a libation to the rest of the universe. You can surely leave that much. If you get 99.44% back on your investment, consider yourself fortunate. I'm fooling with language here to help you to appreciate the humanity of this thing. Notice that our movement and counter-movement leave this little threshold, and that little threshold we're referring to here as the stand. As the stand. Now this form, movement, counter-movement, and stand, is an archaic dance form. This archaic dance form was made in archaic Greece at the same time that proto-geometric pottery was introduced. The Greek word for this kind of dance was chorea. Chorea. Later on, because the because in this movement, counter-movement stand, because language, sung, chanted language is natural.